Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Look deeper.
Well, hello there, friends, and welcome back. I'm your host, Melanie Peterson, and today we're going to talk about Charlie Brandt. Brandt seems like your completely normal, average, everyday guy. Everyone who knew him said he was such a gentle soul, perhaps a little eccentric, but definitely an agreeable and calm guy. So why did Charlie Brandt, a man who no one ever said a bad word about, brutally stab his wife Terry and mutilate and decapitate his niece Michelle Jones in September 2004 before committing suicide while they were all huddled in Michelle's home to take shelter during a pending hurricane? A few days after the murders, Charlie's older sister Angela showed up to the police station with a story, a deep, dark secret that she and her family had been hiding from the world for the last 3 decades. When she sat down with lead investigator Rob Hemmert, even he wasn't prepared for what Angela was about to tell him. It turns out, Charlie had killed before when he was 13 years old, and being a minor when he committed the crimes, he was never charged for the murders, and the records were sealed. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. Carl Charlie Brandt was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana, to parents Herbert and Ilse Brandt. His parents were originally from Germany and had immigrated to the United States, first living in Texas, before moving to the East Coast and settling in Connecticut. Those who knew Charlie as a child remembered him as being shy, but overall a good kid and a good student. His family noted that when faced with new surroundings, he did have a bit of trouble adjusting, but nothing major or alarming that would have given them cause for concern. Eventually, the family moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana in 1968 when his father transferred to a new job at the International Harvesters plant. Brandt would spend most of his life living in Fort Wayne, but the family also took regular vacations to Florida, where he and his father would go hunting. On January 3, 1971, things in the Brandt home would change forever. The incident that took place was what Angela had needed to speak with Rob Hemmert about. When she came into the police station, she was overwhelmed and sat there crying before she could even muster up the control to speak. She was 15 at the time, and what had happened haunted her for over 30 years. Angela remembers reading in her bedroom around 9 p.m., getting ready for bed. Her mother, Ilse, who was 8 months pregnant, was in the bathtub, and her father was in the bathroom shaving. Suddenly, Angela heard her father yell, "Charlie, don't!" followed quickly by several gunshots. Charlie had walked into the bathroom and shot his father in the back 3 times before turning the gun on his mother and firing 4 shots into her, killing her and her baby. Angela, terrified at what she had heard, watched as her younger brother came into her bedroom and stared at her before raising the gun in her direction. He pulled the trigger, but it only clicked, not firing, because it was empty. Realizing that this was their chance, she ran at her brother and grabbed him, holding him as he tried to fight back and telling him that she loved him, trying to get him to calm down. Angela recalled, quote, "I saw the madness, the glazed over look. I saw it disappear," end quote. Finally convinced that she had calmed Charlie down enough, she ran screaming from the house over to a neighbor's to get help, leaving Charlie wondering aloud, what had he just done? Angela's bloody nightgown was flapping as she leapt through the snow up to the neighbor's front door. She began pounding on the door with all of her might. Sandy Radcliffe, then 16 years old, jumped at the loud banging on her front door and was hesitant to open it. Angela, seeing no response, quickly sprinted to the next house when she saw her brother emerge from their home. When Sandy finally opened the door, after another calmer, quieter knock, she didn't see Angela, she only saw Charlie standing there, who after a few moments of silence told her, quote, "Sandy, I just shot my mom and dad," end quote. An ambulance rushed to the home and took Herbert to the hospital, where lead detective Dan Feigl had rushed to meet him, hoping that he would survive and give the police some insight as to what had happened. Herbert was critically wounded, but would end up surviving the incident, all the while telling police he had no idea why his son would have done this. With this admission, Feigl took Charlie into custody, noting that the teenager appeared to be in shock. Feigl stated, quote, "He was in shock, his eyes were dilated, and he couldn't understand why he had done this," end quote. No one seemed to understand how this quiet, reserved 13-year-old boy could have suddenly snapped and shot his parents. Charlie was ordered by the Indiana courts to undergo psychological evaluations. Three separate evaluations, to be exact, and yet no one, including psychiatrist Ronald Pantsner, could get a read on the boy. They all, quote, agreed that Charlie was something of a mystery, end quote. Pantsner looked for any signs of mental illness, but Charlie didn't show any signs or symptoms that would indicate such. After speaking with Charlie about his friends, his family, school, interests, anything that might give an indication as to why this had happened, Pantsner concluded that there wasn't anything to diagnose, but there was clearly something wrong with Charlie. There had to be some reason, some explanation for why this boy had suddenly turned violent. All of the psych evaluations turned up nothing, nothing that could be credited with why Charlie Brandt had gunned down his father and murdered his mother before trying to kill his sister. And because of his age, he was, quote, too young to be held criminally responsible for his crimes, so he was never charged with murder and he was never brought to trial. Instead, a grand jury investigated and issued an ominous warning, writing that such antisocial conduct could repeat itself in the future, end quote. As a compromise, Charlie was sent to a psychiatric hospital where he remained for over a year until his father Herbert had begged and pleaded enough that he forgave his son in order for Charlie to be released. Shortly after Charlie was let out, Herbert packed up the entire family and moved to Florida to get married and attempt to start over somewhere new. He knew they couldn't stay in Fort Wayne because everyone knew what had happened, and he didn't want Charlie to be looked at sideways every time he stepped outside their home. It really seemed like Herbert wanted to just forget the whole thing ever happened, but according to their neighbor, Eleanor Chris, who lived in the second house Angela fled to on the night of the shootings, recalled that Herbert seemed, quote, at first reluctant to take the boy back after his release. When Carl Brandt returned home, he was confined to the house and kept away from view, end quote. In Angela's conversation with Detective Hemmert, she said she didn't think her father ever asked Charlie why he had done what he did. No, why did you shoot me? No, why did you kill your mother? Nothing. Herbert just welcomed his son back into his arms without question, and in an even more shocking reveal, the two youngest children in the Brandt family, two sisters of Angela and Charlie, had never been told the real reason why their mother had died. Melanie and Jessica were toddlers when the shootings happened and actually had slept through the entire ordeal. Both girls grew up having no idea that their older brother had tried to annihilate his entire family. With Angela's admission after the discovery of the murders of Charlie's wife Terry and niece Michelle, the truth was only just beginning to come out. Michelle's parents, Bill and Mary Lou, were furious at the new information, stating, quote, "There's something wrong here. There's something wrong with a system that allows a 13-year-old boy to kill his mother, to try to kill his father and an older sister, and nothing was done. I don't think she, Terry, would have married him, period, at all, had she known," end quote. Even more so, they are pretty sure Charlie never told Terry about the murder or his stay in a psychiatric hospital, and they also hold Herbert and Angela somewhat responsible for the deaths of Terry and their daughter Michelle because, quote, they should have known that Charlie had the potential and capacity to kill. Mary Lou added that Herbert never made any effort to say how sorry he was that this happened to us, end quote. So where does the responsibility lay? With Charlie for actually committing the murders? With his father Herbert for neglecting to tell his daughter-in-law what his son was capable of? With Angela for only coming forward after two more people had died because of her brother? Hard to say.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
In September 2004, Hurricane Ivan was churning in the Atlantic Ocean, creeping closer and closer to the Florida Keys. Charlie Brandt, now 47 years old, lived on Big Pine Key with his wife Terry and was employed by Lockheed Martin as a radar technician. When the evacuation order was given on September 2nd, Terry's niece, 37-year-old Michelle Jones, invited her aunt and uncle to come stay at her house in Altamonte Springs, just north of Orlando, to ride out the storm, and she was thrilled when they accepted her offer. Terry was the sister of Michelle's mother, Mary Lou, and enjoyed a very close relationship with her niece. Michelle opened her home to Terry and Charlie. They swam in her pool, they hung out in the jacuzzi, and Mary Lou recalled how they all seemed to be having a good time. She was getting daily updates from her daughter, and there was really nothing to worry about. The hurricane was far enough away that they were out of danger. And then on September 13th, Mary Lou called Michelle, wanting to find out how the rest of their weekend went, but Michelle didn't pick up the phone. She tried again later, but the phone went straight to voicemail. And this was unusual because Michelle usually answered her phone, and if not, she would call her mother back pretty quickly. The following day, Mary Lou called her daughter again, but there was still no answer, and she was starting to get concerned. By Wednesday, September 15th, Mary Lou had still not been able to get a hold of Michelle, so she called Michelle's friend Debbie to swing by the house and check on them. When Debbie arrived, she had Mary Lou on the phone with her as she walked up the driveway. The front door was locked, and her key wasn't working for some reason, so she began to walk around the back of the house towards the garage. As she approached the garage, Debbie recalled, quote, there was a door with almost all glass, so you could see in. I was in shock, end quote. Through the glass door, Debbie saw Charlie's lifeless body hanging from a rafter. He had committed suicide. Debbie hung up with Mary Lou and quickly called the police. When investigator Rob Hemmert arrived at the home, he saw Brandt's body hung with a bedsheet by the neck and a ladder nearby. Even with as awful a discovery as this, he stated that nothing could have prepared him for the gruesome display inside. Charlie's wife Terry was found on the couch, slumped over, having, quote, been stabbed 7 times in the chest. Michelle's mutilated body, decapitated, with her heart removed, was in her room, end quote. Investigators noted that the house had been locked and there was no indication of a struggle or any kind of evidence. The dinner dishes and some wine glasses were still in the kitchen. At one point, the evening seemed to be like any other, and then something changed. At one point, Michelle's friend Lisa had called and was planning to stop over for a visit, but Lisa told police that Michelle asked her not to come. Michelle had told her, quote, Terry and Charlie had been arguing and they weren't in the best of company. They had a little too much to drink, end quote. Hemmert would eventually discover that that day, Terry and Charlie had planned to leave. Their packed bags were by the front door, but for some reason, Charlie wanted to stay another night. In trying to determine why they didn't leave that day, Hemmert said, quote, the hurricane had passed, so he chose to stay for a reason. I think that was because he knew what he was going to do, end quote. The murders had been carried out meticulously. They were thought out, and he had taken his time. Terry had been stabbed with one of Michelle's kitchen knives in rapid succession, killing her quickly. Michelle, on the other hand, was stabbed once in the chest. Charlie had removed her clothes, drenched in blood, and placed them in her bathroom sink. It was then that he went back to dismember her body. Why he chose to kill his wife one way and his niece in another is still something of a mystery for investigators. And Mary Lou couldn't comprehend how this man that she had known for 17 years, who was quiet, mild-mannered, this man had brutally murdered her daughter and her sister. It just didn't make sense to anyone. A friend of Terry's, Melanie Fetcher, never remembered the couple fighting and was dumbfounded that a man who loved his wife as much as Charlie loved Terry could have done something so out of character. Police never found a note, nothing with an explanation or something to indicate why Charlie had done what he did. It looked like he had just snapped and done the unthinkable, and that's when Angela showed up, finally, after missing a police briefing for the victim's family members. Hemmert explained that, quote, "She was in a car in the parking lot. She basically came to us and said, 'There's something I need to tell you people,'" end quote. And that's when the horrific dark secrets of Charlie Brandt's past came out. Angela walked police through the events of the night of January 3rd, 1971, in the hopes of explaining what had happened to Terry and Michelle. Even after Hemmert spoke with Angela, and eventually with her and Charlie's father, Herbert, he still couldn't figure out a clear reason for what had happened. He and others involved in the case traveled out to the Florida Keys to search Charlie and Terry's home, still boarded up from the hurricane. He noted how meticulous the house had been prepared for the storm. The boarding was, for lack of a better word, perfect. He stated, quote, "I'd never seen anything like it. Charlie took it to the extreme. Every piece of wooden panel that was cut for each window looked like it had been custom fit. The holes for the doorknobs and the French doors were meticulously cut, perfectly round circles," end quote. It was something that had clearly taken time and was done with precision. Charlie worked as a radar technician, so precision like that was in his wheelhouse, but once Hemmert and his team stepped foot inside the home, one thing they found sent chills down their spine. Hemmert was searching the Brandt's bedroom when he noticed a poster hanging on the back of their bedroom door. It was a poster with a very graphic depiction of the female anatomy, something you would be more likely to see in a doctor's office, but not in the home of a radar technician, let alone in their bedroom. This is something that Terry would have seen on a daily basis, and yet no one ever heard of it being a cause for concern. No one friendly with the Brandts was aware of any issues regarding this poster, which showed the skeletal and muscular systems of a female body. Definitely something that would have been of interest to someone in the medical profession, but to outsiders, it looked out of place. As Hemmert stood there looking at the poster, he felt his heart thump in his chest. He had seen something like this before, when they discovered Michelle's body. Brandt had, quote, "duplicated or exposed some of those areas of the body in what he did with Michelle," end quote. Police also found other medical journals, notebooks, and even an anatomy book. A newspaper clipping with a human heart on it was found between the pages of the book. Things were starting to become clearer. They were starting to fall into place. However, one of the main questions was why there was such a stark difference in Terry and Michelle's murders. Terry had been killed quickly with multiple stab wounds. Michelle only had one stab wound, and then she was mutilated and decapitated. Her heart was exposed and then removed from her body, and it seemed more like a surgical experiment for a dementedly curious individual. And why Michelle? Hemmert discovered that Charlie may have had an infatuation with his niece, perhaps even an obsession. Brandt apparently would never call her by her name, instead referring to her as Victoria's Secret. There were also multiple Victoria's Secret catalogs discovered in the Brandt home, all addressed to Charlie. Further findings exposed an even darker side to Brandt. A search on his computer revealed that he had, quote, "been on ghastly websites that featured death fantasies, necrophilia, and violence against women," end quote, which led police to believe that he may have gotten some of his inspiration in his final murder spree from these websites, as well as the medical books and the journals he kept. The precision with how he had removed Michelle's head and her heart also alerted them to the fact that This was most likely not his first time, that he had probably committed similar acts in the past, aside from the shootings as a teenager. Someone doesn't just cut off a head and remove a heart with the kind of precision that Brandt had without having done it at least once or twice before. So with what they knew of Brandt, the murders, his love of traveling, police began looking into other unsolved murders that seemed to fit Brandt's MO that may also have fit his travel routes and had similarities to Terry and especially Michelle's murders. Soon, there was a giant stack of possible cases to work through, and investigators, including criminal profiler Leslie D'Ambrosia, worked through each of them, trying to identify a pattern or cases with similarities. While looking for a potential serial killer's identifying characteristics might seem like following a checklist, D'Ambrosia stated, quote, "There's no boilerplate profile for a serial killer. It doesn't exist. It's all individual. How a person normally behaves is translated into how they carry out their crimes," end quote. Brandt was, by nature, a very precise person, and the methodology with which he carried out his crimes reflected a very high level of precision. And yet nothing in Brandt's background, other than the murder of his mother, which very few knew about, indicated that he was capable of such brutal precision. Angela's ex-husband Jim Graves said of Brandt, quote, "He was so gentle that when there was a bug in the house, he would refuse to step on it and carried it outside," end quote. After Angela told Jim about her brother's history, he recalled that despite what had happened years prior, Brandt seemed just fine. But of course, hindsight is 20/20, and Jim Graves does seem to hold some residual guilt for not focusing on or being alarmed at certain things that Brandt had said to him. When Jim and Angela split up, Graves went fishing with Charlie just to talk about things, and years later, a seemingly brutish comment that Brandt made as they spoke about revenge, perhaps at the time made to sound like it was in jest or just a guy being supportive of another guy going through a hard time, left Jim with an uneasy feeling both after the conversation and years later, having realized that Brandt was probably serious when he said, quote, "Well, if you really want to get revenge, you should kill somebody and cut their heart out," end quote. Jim remembers this statement made him feel really uneasy, but again, at the time, Charlie was a kind, quiet man who no one ever suspected of violent tendencies, and if this slip-up was one of the few insights anyone has ever really had into the true nature of Charlie Brandt, what had Michelle done to him that he thought he needed to exact revenge on her by killing her, disemboweling her, cutting off her head, and removing her heart? Had he felt rejected by her, or perhaps like he could never have her because of his marriage to Terry? Was this a case of, if I can't have her, no one can? No one knows. Jim would actually also play a part in Charlie and Terry's eventual marriage. A woman he was dating after his divorce from Angela had a friend that she wanted to set up with someone, so Jim called Charlie. Fast forward to August 29th, 1986, Charlie married Terry with Jim standing by his side. Jim did feel a little apprehensive about Terry not knowing about Charlie's past, so he had a conversation with him about telling his wife, and Charlie told him that he had talked to Terry already, telling her about his mother's death. And months later, during a visit, Jim asked the "so when are you kids gonna have kids" question, and Terry told him she didn't think it was a good idea. And making a big assumption, Jim concluded that Terry really did know everything, so his mind was put a little more at ease. But after the murders of Terry and Michelle, Jim still wonders if she really did know about his past. And many of the investigators want to know more about Charlie because they had a hard time believing that he would have just snapped and then murdered his niece in the same way that he described to his buddy Jim while sitting there fishing. They knew he traveled throughout the United States. They knew he traveled overseas. Were there other crimes, other assaults, or even murders that Charlie Brandt was responsible for over the span of 30 years between the murder of his mother and then the murders of his wife and his niece? While police were able to link him to 26 unsolved murders in Florida as far back as 1973, there were two cases specifically that really seemed to fit Brandt's profile. The first was the 1995 murder of Darlene Toler. Darlene was a sex worker in Miami, and her mutilated body was discovered on the side of a highway. Detective Pat Diaz, who worked this investigation, recalled that Darlene's murder was unusual because the murderer had cut off her head and took out her heart, just like Brandt's niece, Michelle Jones. Darlene's body was then wrapped in a blanket and plastic and tied up. This was clearly not a murder done in the heat of the moment. Her killer took his time. He made sure that what he did was done in an isolated area so he wouldn't be interrupted. It was precise, just like Brandt. Brandt, who also kept track of the miles on his truck whenever he put gas in his car. The body mutilation is one reason why Detective Diaz is very sure that Brandt is the one responsible for her death. It's a very specific way to kill someone. Additionally, in Brandt's mileage tracking, they noticed that, quote, a spike occurs right around the time Toler was killed, 100 miles away from Brandt's home, end quote. Diaz believes it's entirely possible that Brandt could have driven all the way to Miami in search of his next victim. He had the time. He would go with very little suspicion from his wife because they worked opposite shifts. And furthermore, the police also found dog hair on the blanket that was visibly very similar to dog hair found in Brandt's truck. According to Diaz, if DNA confirmation of the dog hair is made, then he would be able to confidently wrap up Darlene's case with Charlie Brandt named as her killer. The second case that police suspect Brandt is responsible for has even more convincing evidence than Darlene Toler's. One evening in July 1989, the body of 38-year-old Sherry Parachot was pulled out of the water under a bridge near Big Pine Key, just 4 blocks from where Charlie Brandt lived. Sherry lived nearby on a small boat and got around mostly using her bike. Her body was found mutilated, just like Darlene Toler and just like Michelle Jones, decapitated and her heart removed. The boat showed clear signs that it had been used as a cutting table, according to Monroe County Homicide Detective Trish Daly. Detective Daly was the lead on this case and stated, quote, what we believed happened is that she was placed on the bottom of the boat, possibly with her feet off the stern, end quote. The body's condition, the marks on the bottom of the boat, and a sketch of a man spotted near the crime scene running across the highway were all police had to go on for a short time. But eventually, that wouldn't be all. Jim Graves would end up contacting the police in regards to what Terry told him shortly after Sherry's murder. He told them how Terry considered calling the police, quote, because of Charlie's past, end quote. Another clue that Charlie had told his wife about his mother. But also, Terry had more than just his past to consider her husband as potentially being involved. Jim said, quote, she apparently found Charlie downstairs and he had blood on him. And she asked him what had happened, and he gave an excuse that he was filleting fish, although it was a work day. It was in the evening. She went ahead and believed him, end quote. With this confession, police believe they had enough to close the case on Sherry's murder. Charlie Brandt was their main suspect. Even with Terry's suspicion that her husband had brutally murdered a woman not far from their home, she seemed to look the other way. I mean, honestly, who wants to believe that the person they love, that the person they share a life with, could be capable of such heinous acts of violence? It really seems like Charlie was able to compartmentalize the good parts of his life from the dark parts. He hid behind a wall of normalcy, a mask of sanity, if you will. He had everyone in his life fooled, or so distracted by his everyday behavior that when something egregiously wrong popped up, it was enough to cause them to not see that outlier for what it really was, a warning, a red flag, reality. And even with all this evidence that Charlie Brandt was a murderer hiding behind a calm, sensible demeanor, both authorities and those who knew him will probably never really know why he did what he did or what his actual mental state was. This wasn't just a case of a man snapping under stress or having a bad moment. This was the real Charlie Brandt, and he was just really, really good at hiding it. And family members of Terry and Michelle partly blame Angela and her father Herbert, who passed away in March 2009, for helping Charlie hide his true self. Brandt's record from his stay in the psychiatric hospital has been sealed at the request of his family. And it's possible that these records, which would include his types of treatment and diagnosis, could be helpful in understanding Bryant's psyche, but so far, nothing has been revealed. Mary Lou and Bill, Michelle's parents, believe that Angela and Herbert Brandt didn't do enough to protect Terry and Michelle, that they were too concerned about protecting themselves and protecting Charlie instead of getting him help so this tragedy never would have happened. Mary Lou doesn't believe her sister would have stayed with Brandt if she had known the truth about him and his past, even though Jim Graves is pretty sure that Terry knew about those parts of Charlie's life. And it also doesn't help the situation, in my opinion, that apparently Angela even told Mary Lou after the murders that Angela can now relax and sleep more easily because, quote, for 20-some years, she would not allow the air conditioner to run, the windows to be open, and unlocked in her home because she was afraid. She was afraid Charlie would come back to kill her, end quote. I'm sorry, but if you're that terrified of your brother, then that means he's shown behavior since the murder of your mother, which makes you believe this isn't a one-time thing and that he is definitely capable of doing it again. Now, it might have been difficult to get someone in charge to believe her, or maybe there wasn't any kind of attempt. None of us really know at this point because this case is so convoluted. But if you're that afraid and you don't speak up and let the people in his life know, like his wife, and then those people end up murdered by the same person that you're afraid of, I do partly agree with Mary Lou and Bill Jones that there is a certain level of responsibility there in the deaths of Terry and Michelle for Angela and Herbert. Unfortunately, while this case is technically closed because they know who killed Terry and Michelle, they will never know the why behind it. Why them? Why did Brandt kill them in different but equally specific ways? What was going on in his head during the murders? What was he hiding? Could doctors have missed a key psychological diagnosis during his stay at the psychiatric hospital? Just so many questions that will remain unanswered, leaving the family members of Terry and Michelle with an emptiness that doesn't give them any peace or any closure in their untimely deaths. And if one thing's for sure, it's that Mary Lou and Bill want to make sure that something like this never happens again. The Joneses, quote, are pushing for a public database, much like that for sex offenders, including anyone of any age who has ever killed another person, regardless of the circumstances, end quote. All right, friends, that was Charlie Brandt. Definitely one of the more confusing cases I've covered. Brandt was terrifying because he had so many people in his life fooled into thinking that he was anything but a murderer. But it's very likely that he was a serial killer who was just never caught. Based on what police found on his computer, he harbored a secret hatred of women but also seemed to be obsessed with his niece Michelle in a very unnatural way. At the time of his mother's murder, psychiatrists couldn't find any evidence of mental illness, but a lot has changed in the time between the murders in 1971 and the ones in 2004. There may have been signs of an illness that were missed because they weren't common or weren't known to doctors. The antisocial behavior that was noted by doctors as possibly recurring should have been more closely monitored, in my opinion. I can't really fully support the Joneses in blaming Angela for withholding information or not getting her brother help, but their father, Herbert, is a different story. He is the parent. He was the adult when the first act of violence occurred, and he seemed to turn a blind eye to his son and his issues, ignoring the problem and moving the family away instead of realizing that Charlie needed continual support and treatment. Unfortunately, the ramifications of his decision to ignore Charlie's mental health came back tenfold in 2004. All right. Thank you to everyone who has sent their suggestions to Mask of Sanity on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. For anyone who hasn't sent me suggestions of killers you'd like me to cover, you can always reach out. And if you haven't done so yet, please follow the Oracle Network on Twitter and Instagram as well. It's at Oracle Network, OracleNetwork. Please check out our website. We have lots of amazing shows there. You can check out their bios, listen to episodes, click on any of their own specific links for their Patreon, merch, anything like that. And speaking of merch, I also now have a merch store. The link is in the episode notes if you're interested. There's lots of cool things. I actually have a face mask now that says Mask of Sanity on it, and I wear it, and I love the occasionally odd looks that I get from wearing it. But face masks are kind of a big thing right now, so if you're looking for a way to support the show and keep yourself and others safe, then maybe look at purchasing a face mask. And please stick around after the show for the trailer, Murmur Murders Podcast. It's a pretty cool show. Definitely check them out. Give them a listen. Subscribe. My resources and my Patreon link, for those of you interested, are always in my episode notes as well. Thank you all so, so much for listening, and join me next week when I go down under and cover Australia's most lethal serial killer, John Justin Bunting, and the Snowtown Murders. Until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, greetings and salutations, and welcome to the Murmur Murders Podcast. If you enjoy deep dives or thought-provoking true crime shows, I'm afraid I have some bad news for you, because this ain't it. But if you do enjoy true crime stories told in 30 minutes or less with a dash of humor and well-timed puns, whether you're on your way to work, taking a quick break, or if you have nothing else better to do with your life, then maybe, just maybe, this is the podcast for you. You can find this podcast on all the major platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and many others. Make sure to follow me on social media platforms such as Instagram and Twitter at Murmur Murders. That's MURMURMURDERS. Hope to hear from you, and until next time on the Murmur Murders Podcast.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.